This is the full story from WSHU Public Radio. I'm Tom Kuser. Today we're highlighting two investigative projects from our reporters that deal with how ethnic communities in our region can become targets of xenophobia. We begin with the three-part series, Virus of Hate, which examines anti-Asian and Pacific Islander bias in our region. WSHU senior editor Cassandra Basler reported and produced this series, and she joins us on the phone. Hi, Cassie.
Hi, Tom.
You begin the series with the increase in attacks of various types against Asian Americans in our area, starting when the coronavirus pandemic spread into the Northeast. What were the first signs of this trend that you discovered?
Sitting in the newsroom, I think the first signs we saw of this rise in anti-Asian harassment came in New York City, specifically on the subway. There was a tweet that went viral where a woman was being attacked. Someone threw a water bottle at her. And it was a woman who, you know, she was wearing a mask and also like glasses, presumably to sort of use protection against the virus in these really early days. I think it was early March, before we really knew much about how the virus spread or whether everybody was supposed to, you know, wear PPE or personal protective equipment. And the fact that she was being yelled at and berated really shocked a lot of people. And as time went on, we started to hear that more and more of these sorts of things were happening to people of Asian or Pacific Islander descent, even in New Haven, Connecticut. So what prompted our series was that, you know, we understand that it's really difficult for people to talk about times where they might have been victimized or harassed like this. And part of the nuance of it is that sometimes people might be acting strangely and you don't really know as a person of a marginalized identity if they're acting strangely towards you because you might look Asian and they're worried about the coronavirus, or if they're acting strangely because they're really concerned about social distancing and they don't want to be around anybody, say grocery shopping or walking around outside. So the series really explores the sort of more outrageous violent attacks and the subtler ways people are experiencing this kind of hate right now.
I was going to ask you, these incidents were more or have been more than verbal attacks. There have been actual physical attacks involved, either against individuals or against property, actual physical attacks involved in these situations.
Yes, there have been several incidents documented by a group called Stop AAPI Hate. That's an official organization that does statistical analysis of accounts of harassment, ranging from anything from verbal harassment to people being spit on or punched in the face. Two folks in New York City reported that they were kicked on the street walking in Manhattan. Another man who was walking his child to the bus stop was pushed. And in those instances, we don't know a lot about the identity of the victims because the folks who come forward often ask to remain anonymous, often because they don't want to attract more harassment by stepping forward and letting people know their identity. Ironically, that's what happens to a lot of folks on, you know, social media these days. So Stop AAPI Hate finds that most of these violent incidents are happening in places like New York City or California, where there are really large populations of Asian and Pacific Islander communities. So in Connecticut, I wasn't able to find a ton of documented incidents of physical attacks. The most physical altercation I had heard about was from Attorney General William Tong. He had received a call to his office describing how one woman was sprayed with Lysol by a grocery store attendant while she was shopping. And the grocery store attendant had asked her specifically, "Are you from China, or when were you last in China?" Sort of implying that because this person might have been to China or is Asian, she might be carrying coronavirus, which we know through public health accounts and basically all of science now that the ethnicity of a person has nothing to do with how the virus spreads.
You mentioned that some people will come forward but want to remain anonymous when they report incidents. Is there any estimate of the number of situations that have occurred and perhaps not reported at all?
We don't have hard data about how many unreported incidents there are, But what we do know is this group, Stop AAPI Hate, has found that there are more than 2,000 incidents that have been reported since the start of March. Those were numbers as of the end of June when I last contacted their researchers. So they're continually updating that. And those incidents are everything from, like I said, spitting or verbal attacks. And the sense that we get is that there are much more reports. They think that there's a lack of knowledge about how to make anonymous reports about things like verbal attacks, where you might not think to call the police because it wasn't a physical assault. And even the law enforcement officials at the federal level have said they worry that these incidents are underreported.
Now, we've seen in recent weeks in our region, in Connecticut and New York, the number of COVID-19 cases decreasing quite a bit. Has that had any effect that you know of through your reporting on incidents of bias? Are there fewer of them in our region at this point?
We don't have that kind of granular data about how week to week those might be decreasing as the coronavirus numbers look like they're decreasing. But what we do know is that the largest correlation between the number of attacks and the severity of attacks go with not necessarily the number of cases, but with the size of the Asian and Pacific Islander community in that state. So, for instance, California, the San Francisco area, you might have seen a viral video of Silicon Valley tech person berating an Asian family, telling them that, you know, Trump was going to get them for coronavirus. Those are the types of things that happen. And from what the researchers I've talked to have theorized, it sounds like just increased contact with people of Asian descent mean that folks who are outraged about coronavirus and are looking for someone to blame or scapegoat tend to take it out on them.
In your second report, you explain how what we're going through right now is not really new, that similar xenophobic acts occurred during past pandemics, specifically a bubonic plague outbreak in San Francisco.
That's right. So through the several interviews I had with professors who've been studying the history of Asian American immigration and xenophobia in the United States, they said, anyone who studies this says what we're seeing now with the pandemic is nothing new. Throughout history, politicians and newspapers have sort of used immigrants and often Asian immigrants to blame public health emergencies on somebody other than, you know, the incompetency of the public health response of the government. So what we saw in San Francisco was really interesting because they used to call this bubonic plague, you know, the China plague, as if it only was a disease that could affect residents of Chinatown, which at the time was mainly a neighborhood next to the shipping ports. They got a lot of rodents because of their proximity to the shipping industry. Rats would come off of the boats. And essentially, they had one reported case of somebody who had the bubonic plague in Chinatown and assumed that was the only case. And over time, after years, they realized that this plague had been spreading through fleas on rats, which can roam freely across neighborhoods in San Francisco. And white people were also dying of this plague, but they were just calling it something else. They assumed, the doctors assumed it was pneumonia, and they had these racist assumptions that white people didn't need to worry about this disease.
I'd like to jump to the third report in your series. We've got a couple of minutes left to talk about this. You ended the series with a report about the way hate has led to activism. And you mentioned that you spoke with Connecticut Attorney General William Tong. How is his office responding to these reports of hate?
I think the most interesting thing about the conversation I had with Attorney General William Tong was that his office is not equipped to tackle civil rights violations like hate crimes. Mostly, the state of Connecticut has only empowered the attorney general to file lawsuits. So while he was accepting calls and reports from people who were saying, I experienced this incident of harassment, he couldn't actually do anything about it in his office. There are a couple other ways that he could point people to report incidents like that. In the case of the Lysol spraying or disinfectant spraying of a shopper in Stamford, Connecticut, he suggested she could go to the police because the act of being sprayed with a liquid is technically assault. But, you know, he doesn't have the power to prosecute anything at the criminal level. So actually, before the pandemic, his office wanted to lobby the state legislature to allow him to establish a formal civil rights office where he could take complaints like that and actually act on them. But unfortunately, the state legislature had to postpone their meeting because they couldn't meet in person to vote on anything due to the spread of the virus. So what we're learning now is that it's very tough to get recourse for a hate crime. Essentially, if a person didn't witness or record somebody saying the slur during the act, it's hard to prove that an incident was motivated by racism.
I'd like to ask you, too, about something that is really part of the process of reporting this series. You worked with a sensitivity editor. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I'd love to. So I am a white woman from the Midwest. So in my reporting on this, I tried to do as much research and interview as many sociologists and experts in Asian history as possible. But I know that despite that, I will never have the knowledge and nuance and sensitivity of somebody who is Asian or Asian American to understand sort of what are the issues coming from the community that really need to be reported on in a sensitive, nuanced way. So I ended up looping in with a podcaster and documentary filmmaker named James Boo. He produces the show Self-Evident, which is a show by Asian American and Pacific Islander journalists for Asian American and Pacific Islander audiences. So he was also studying this issue and was reporting his own series for his podcast. And we had been talking about ways that, you know, our audiences might be different. The NPR audience in particular skews a little bit, you know, over 50, usually college educated and largely white. So we were talking about, you know, how could I help sort of capture this issue and explain it to an audience that maybe never had to think about anti-Asian racism before or what it looks like or might not even realize that it exists. So James was able to help me sort of flag things that might have been implicit biases of people I interviewed that I featured without realizing it. And we sort of were able to frame the stories and the anecdotes I collected in a way that can help people understand from a sort of culturally competent framework what exactly is happening today and whether or not it's different from other instances in the past. I think there's a really big misconception that racism sort of ended after the civil rights movement in the 60s or after President Barack Obama was elected. And I think the protests after the police killing of George Floyd this year have really shown the ways that it's deeply ingrained in our society and we have a lot to unpack still.
It's a three-part series called Virus of Hate. It was reported and investigated by WSHU's senior editor, Cassandra Basler. If you didn't get a chance to hear it, go to our website, WSHU.org. You can find it there. Cassie, thanks for your work on this report. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Tom.
Joining us now is James Boo. He worked with our reporter, Cassandra Basler, on her series as a sensitivity editor. He's also the managing producer of the podcast, Self-Evident. Hello, James.
Hey, Tom. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
I'd like to know how you got connected with the series to begin with, the series of reports that Cassie did.
You know, it actually started in social media. I think Cassie had seen one of our listeners share an email that we had sent to all of our subscribers, which offered a list of resources for Asian American communities who were trying to make sense of all of this that's going on regarding anti-Asian racism. And this was very, very early on in the pandemic, before I think it became very clear how big of a problem this would be. So we kind of saw the issue and were trying to offer some affirmation and some resources to our listeners. And then that got shared out. And I think Cassie saw it and reached out because she saw some of the same issues and had some of the same concerns and was just happy to see a conversation about it.
Now, we've described you as a sensitivity editor. I'm guessing a lot of people might not have heard that term before, that particular title or role in connection with reporting. Could you tell us about the responsibilities of a sensitivity editor and what part you play in the reporting of a story like Cassie's?
You know, it's funny. I don't know if sensitivity is the best word for this kind of work, because what we're really doing is expanding an understanding of context, right? To be specific, I work with Cassie on the story by reviewing drafts. And having done a lot of my own reporting and spending a lot of time with Asian American and some Pacific Islander community members who were dealing with the same issues, I just had a lot of extra information, but also lived experience. And so in some ways, I'm functioning kind of as a source and an advisor. It's not necessarily a problem of sensitivity or insensitivity, but you don't know what you don't know. And I think a lot of people may get hung up on, am I being sensitive enough in the how I say things, very focused on the micro wording, which is important. If you're only one reporter, then you're going to have some blind spots. If you don't come from the communities where the issue is taking place, then you definitely won't have all of that history to draw on. And the same goes for me. You know, I have plenty of blind spots. I do not have direct experience with a lot of the community issues. And I'm just happy to be helpful because of reporting work that I've done to gain that experience as well. So we're all being aware of the fact that a single reporter, a single newsroom can't have this kind of omnipresent knowledge of people's lived experience. And it's putting in the time to recognize that and then try to take it into account when you write the story.
When it comes to reporting on the Asian American community, especially since the onset of COVID-19, what do you think journalists often miss or get wrong when they're doing that reporting?
This is kind of a classic. I think it's that there is no Asian American community. That is a very flat aggregate picture. And you start to see the true lived experience of people when you get much more specific, much more local, which is why I love radio and the ability to sit with local communities who come from much more specific circumstances, whether we're talking about low-income immigrant communities who are impacted in a completely different way, right, from folks of my background who are second generation, kind of middle to higher middle income or even wealthy. And by starting with local communities and starting with people's lived experience on the ground, we can really quickly get past this very flat picture of the Asian American community and start to focus on what's really going on and how those experiences affect people's lives.
So I've made note of that. I got that wrong. So thank you for correcting me on that term. Are there stories that you think the media hasn't covered that you believe need their attention in connection with what the pandemic is doing to the way people think?
You know, I've been pleasantly surprised by the amount of ongoing attention that the anti-Asian racism sentiments, hate incidents are getting. And I think a lot of that is due to the work of advocacy groups who are very specifically keeping this in the public eye and doing a lot of work to surface the information, perform due diligence, and then notify journalists like you and me, especially at larger newsrooms. Another thing I'd add is the structural element. Almost every newsroom that's worth its salt has identified how inequality plays into this and how different racial groups are impacted differently, that the virus is not an equalizer, but I think it needs to remain at the center of conversation. And rather than looking for leads that focus on what's the new normal, let's continue to acknowledge that things weren't so great in the first place. The pandemic is revealing some pretty dangerous conditions that we need to ask ourselves if we're willing to accept moving forward. And racism is certainly a part of that, but it doesn't only play out in these very acute, easy to identify hate incidents. It also persists in the background and the impact it's had on people that the system is just not working for.
Is the current combination of circumstances, the pandemic, the Black Lives Matter movement, is this a unique moment of transition? Is this a real opportunity to change how we deal with race and bias in the United States?
I personally think it is. I guess I would professionally say that I think it is as well. It's a real moment of reckoning. It's an explosion of consciousness. And I think the emphasis is on opportunity, whether you're looking at defund the police efforts that have come up against the power structure that may not act so quickly on these ideas and these cries for help and these demands for justice, or whether it's just the ongoing need to support all of the Asian Americans who are in economic fallout, which is related to the pandemic, but also has a lot of structural underpinnings.
Your podcast, Self-Evidence, is dedicated to episodes to the pandemic and how the bias connected to it has affected Asian Americans. It sounds like the podcast, generally speaking, shares stories about what it means to be American from a person with an Asian background. Has the focus changed at all during this moment of, I guess you could say, reckoning in our country?
No, I actually think that we're getting closer this year to exactly what we dreamed of when we started the program. It's a simple idea. The reason why it's important to hear from Asian American and Pacific Islander communities isn't for its own sake. It's that their experiences really encapsulate the full range of big questions and challenges that our country is facing. It's culturally, politically, economically, all of these things can be reflected in some community in this greater Asian America. And that's what we certainly believe. It's certainly proven to be true. It means there's no end to the amount of stories that can really shine a light on issues of inequality, issues of justice, but also sources of joy, right, and laughter and community and affirmation that anyone can really find something in, anyone can see themselves in. We're not offering the Asian opinion, but it's really getting to live with the folks who are in our show and kind of identify what's different and take that whole package, because there's a lot of nuances to life and all these conversations deserve that much space.
James, thanks so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Tom.
James Boo is the sensitivity editor on our series Virus of Hate, reported by Cassandra Basler, and also producer of the podcast Self-Evident. While some make it their purpose to spread hate and chaos, others work to stop it, including a nonprofit group based in New York City on a mission to create a united front against all forms of harassment everywhere. It's called Hollaback, and the executive director, Emily May, joins us on the phone now. Hello, Ms. May. Thanks for taking time with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
You have training programs to show people how to deal with harassment, whether it's directed at them or someone else. Could you give us a, sort of an overview of how that works? What kind of training do you offer?
Yeah, so we do a range of training, from bystander intervention training to conflict de-escalation training to resilience, how to respond when you experience harassment. But I would say that the training that most people know us for is bystander intervention training, which is quite simply how to show up for others when you're witnessing them being harassed.
So this is essentially something that happens on the spot, people dealing with harassment as it occurs, real time?
That's correct. And a lot of people think, you know, the only way that they can intervene is to, you know, strap on their superhero spandex, swoop down and beat everybody up, right? We're taught to intervene by Hollywood. But bystander intervention is quite simply, how do you take care of the person being harassed in that moment? And how can you do that in a way that preserves your safety? So at Hollaback, we have five approaches. One is to create a distraction to de-escalate the situation. Two, delegate, find somebody else to intervene on your behalf. Three, document the situation. Four, delay, which is, you know, find some and wait until after it's over and check in on that person. And then the last one is direct. That's the one that everybody thinks about, but we really train people just to set that boundary, say it's not okay, and then to turn your attention to the person being harassed.
I would imagine most people are pretty reluctant to step right in on the spot.
They are, but a lot, the greatest fear that people have that we've seen in all of these trainings we've done, and we've trained over 20,000 people in the past 4 months since the pandemic started, but the number one concern that we see is people scared that they're going to make it worse, right? And that makes sense if we let Hollywood teach us how to intervene. But four of Hollaback's 5 D's of bystander intervention are designed to be indirect forms of intervention so that the person doing the harassing may never even detect, right, that you're trying to disrupt it or any in any kind of way, right? But the person experiencing the harassment will certainly feel your support.
And how about the other group that you have called Heart Mob that deals with harassment that occurs online, on the internet? How does that work? And why did you need a separate group to take on this type of harassment? Is it somehow different?
Yeah, online harassment is a tricky issue. And so the way HeartMob works is that you can report your experience of harassment and you can actually opt into having a group of bystanders that we vet prior to them having, you know, any kind of access to you, and that will show up and help you in that situation. And we built HurtMob because we wanted a quick way for people to get the support that they needed when they experienced online harassment. Online harassment isn't that different from harassment in the street or the grocery store or the workplace, but the technology around it is different. The root cause, racism, sexism, homophobia, the same. But how it shows up is quite different, and so are how you can show up as a bystander into that. So we wanted to really be able to leverage the power of bystanders to show up into these moments of online harassment with HurtMob.
I understand that Hollaback got underway about 15 years ago. I'm wondering, have the types of harassment changed since the pandemic began?
What we've seen since the pandemic has begun is a big rise in anti-Asian, anti-Asian American harassment. But even more than that, we see harassment on the rise across the board. We've looked at data in online harassment, for example, across almost all marginalized identities, harassment at about twice of what it was in 2019. And I think what's going on here is that people are scared. And when people are scared, they're stressed, they're under pressure, bias rears its ugly head, right? It starts to show up. All of us carry implicit bias to some degree, right? But people have it under less control when there are these moments like this where we're experiencing the stress. And certainly our elected officials, especially in the United States, aren't doing us any favor by perpetuating this kinds of hate.
And what about the movement for racial justice that's been re-energized recently? Has that influenced your work?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's been incredible to see the Black Lives Matter movement really just taking off in profound ways. We launched a training on bystander intervention to address anti-Black harassment and police violence, and we have seen a tremendous amount of people show up to that one, probably about 5,000 or so since we've launched it in the past month or two. And that one's a free training. All of our trainings are free. And really encourage folks to look at that, because these tactics of bystander intervention that I mentioned, they work across all forms of hate. But it's really important, especially if you're an ally looking to show up into a type of harassment that you yourself don't experience, to understand deeply what that experience of harassment looks like for that community so that you can be best informed on how you can show up in a way that really takes care of them in a meaningful way, but also ensures your safety.
On your website, you say your group believes, and this is a quote, that we all deserve to be who we are, wherever we are, and we believe this world is not only possible, but imminent. How do you mean that this change is imminent? Can training like yours defeat racism?
Yeah. mean, not alone, right? But look, we're providing these free trainings. We're training tens of thousands of people in this. We're going to have on tap to train another 20,000 people before the end of the year, another 40,000 people before the end of next year. So that's a piece of the puzzle. But look, this is about a large-scale culture shift away from sexism, racism, homophobia, and that's going to take all of us. Right? One organization is not going to do it. It takes all of these organizations, it takes all of the people allied with these organizations, and it takes each of you showing up into this work each and every day. What I love about bystander intervention is it gives tools for everyday people who may not work at these organizations or necessarily have time to volunteer for the larger movement, tools that they can use when they go to the grocery store or walk down the street and see their neighbors experiencing any form of harassment or disrespect.
I mentioned that Hollaback got underway about 15 years ago after a group of seven young friends got together to share their experiences with street harassment. Could you tell me a little bit more about how your organization got up and running?
Yeah, so I was one of those seven kids.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, we were all in our early 20s. And, you know, when we got going, it was really based off of our experiences with gender-based harassment in the street, right? So people saying all kinds of comments to you about your body, what they want to do to you, touching, groping, all of that. And so we were inspired by a young woman named Tao Nguyen who had taken a picture of a man masturbating across from her on a train. And that photo had gone viral. And so we were inspired by her bold action to take, which was in 2005, these newfangled technologies and turn it off of us, right, and the lens off of us and onto that incident of harassment, and doing so bring awareness to it. So we started off as a little blog, right, and it just kept growing. 5 years in 2010, I became our first executive director, and over the past 10 years, we've expanded to look at harassment beyond the street, including online, the workplace, and certainly harassment just beyond the lens of gender, looking deeply at how it impacts various communities of color, immigrants, LGBTQ folks, et cetera, et cetera. So we are continuing to grow and to move, you know, into the space and to be responsive to new and emerging areas, such as voter suppression is one that we are deeply looking into in light of the upcoming U.S. presidential election.
How do people get in touch, or how do people find out about ways to get training? Are they individual sessions, groups, free? Are there fees? Could you tell us a bit more about that?
Of course. So you can go to ihollaback.org. That's I-H-O-L-L-A-B-A-C-K. And right there on that front page, you'll see a little button called Get Trained. There you can see all of our trainings. We offer free trainings to the general public, so you can check our schedule for each of those. And we also offer customized trainings for businesses or groups that are interested in bringing this training in-house.
Emily May is the executive director of Hollaback. Ms. May, thanks so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
This month, we launched a new podcast, Every Town, The Hamptons. It explores the efforts on the east end of Long Island to evict immigrant neighbors from their home. The podcast is the brainchild of WSHU's senior investigative reporter, Charles Lane. And Charles joins us on the phone. Hello, Charles.
Hey, Tom. Thank you for having me.
What is the idea of the Every Town podcast, generally speaking? It's a simple name, but it's really very intriguing. What idea do you want to convey with that?
The idea is that there are national problems that are going unresolved, and those problems replicate themselves across every town in the country. And, you know, I picked, I guess immigration picked me on this one, but you can take almost any gun violence or, you know, Black Lives Matter or any sort of structural racism, education, that on a national level, they're more useful to politicians as wedge issues, not so much to solve, but to attack the opposing party, or at least use to divide an electorate. And one of my frustrations as a journalist going back years is how these wedge issues are not being solved, and they create existential crises in small towns. And I think immigration is a very, very good example of that. It's used as a way to divide an electorate and not as a real, genuine problem that needs to be solved. And then Every Town, The Hamptons, I found a very real example of that. It caused problems in this area of the Hamptons.
I want to ask you, too, about the reason for picking this story, although you just said that this story picked you.
This issue of unresolved national issues has bothered me for a long time. It's not like it's my job to solve it, right? My job is just to report on it. You know, when I talk to my sources, they have real problems, and we always end up sort of at the, if Congress could just get together, if our choices of president were not a difference of who is more aggressive on a certain issue, instead like, okay, who has a better solution for our problem, I think the problems that my sources face, they wouldn't be abstract. They'd just be like, okay, we can just solve this. But I think a lot of times my sources are like, there's just no solution here because we're lacking a solution at the top. Like, there's no need to solve immigration because it's more useful as a political weapon. That's sort of like the long backstory that I've been dealing with as a reporter for a long time. And then, you know, a couple of people gave me tips about the specific hotel, and I saw a very good candidate to tell a much larger story about the struggle over immigration.
Well, the first episode is available via podcast and on the WSHU website as well. It's called A Knock on the Door. You mentioned, of course, the Hamptons. You mentioned the hotel. Can you tell us a bit about what we will be hearing or what we've been able to hear in that first episode, especially for those who have not subscribed yet?
So it takes place in the town of Southampton, and specifically in a neighborhood or a hamlet of Southampton called Hampton Bays, where there is a motel called the Bel Air Cove Motel. In years past, it was a very traditional motel where people would come in and they would stay for a night or a week or maybe 2 weeks, and then they would leave. But as the economy and a couple other things changed within Hampton Bays, this motel became permanent housing for the mostly immigrant workforce of the wealthy people, Hamptonites, the people who summer in the Hamptons. And this one particular hotel, it's a place where mostly there were landscapers, there were caretakers, there were house cleaners. One person was a carpenter, one person built pools. So it's like all the jobs that you need to support the wealthy class, they all live at this one particular hotel.
Now, the second episode drops this weekend. Where does that take the story? Where do we head in the second episode?
The question that we're trying to answer is why the Bel Air was closing. And a lot of people initially think it's a rather straightforward reason why it's closing, but it's not. It is extremely complex. And so I brought a soundbite that really gets to that complexity. It's from a woman by the name of Diana Weir. What she's describing here, she's giving me a tour of the Hamptons, essentially, or Southampton at least. And I think the key thing to know about her is that she is the Southampton town official in charge of housing and community development. And so as we listen to this, she personifies sort of the complexity around the issue.
Tell me really, if you think five Latinos moved into CPI because they could afford it, that anybody would care?
I've seen no evidence to suggest that,
Exactly. Exactly. So it's not as much about race. Is it about race because it just so happens that they're Latinos now? Well, maybe 70 years ago it was Irish. It's about what you can afford. And like Tati said, property values are very important. That's the biggest investment in your life. And if you think or feel, oh, if they're poor, they're going to be this color. If they're poor, they're going to be Hispanic. If they're poorer than me, they're going to be this. That's what drives it. It's not, I believe it's always about the money.
Okay. But let's just take race out of it for a little bit.
Okay.
And is it fair to segregate just on income? Like, have all the rich people over here and all the poor people?
Of course not.
Why not?
Well, because those rich people are going to need somebody to clean their toilets and paint their house and watch their kids. And so where they're going to come? They're going to drop them in on a plane? Like firefighters? So here, we're dropping in the help now. Okay, we'll pick you up and take you home later. No. Any community that is going to be vibrant and sustainable needs a continuum of income levels, a continuum of education, a continuum of everything, because that's what makes a community. Community of all rich people, okay, Nantucket, okay, God, okay, Muffy and Buffy, great.
Yeah, so Diana Weir, her job is essentially to build community and build affordable housing for the workers of the rich. And while she's a devoted advocate towards that, she readily admits that she's not only fighting an uphill battle, but even something as simple as finding a place for the folks at the Bel Air to live, she couldn't help those people.
Charles, thank you, and thanks for your investigation.
No, thank you.
Charles Lane is WSHU's senior investigative reporter. His new podcast is called Every Town, The Hamptons. It explores efforts on the east end of Long Island to evict immigrant neighbors from their home. You can find the podcast series wherever you get your podcasts, and you can also find it on our website, WSHU.org. Connecticut also has challenges when it comes to fair housing. The Connecticut Fair Housing Center is a nonprofit group that gives free investigative and legal services to residents who believe they've been victims of housing discrimination. Erin Kempel is the executive director, and she joins us now on the phone. Ms. Kempel, hello. Thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome, and thank you for having me.
I'd like to ask you first, what constitutes housing discrimination?
The legal definition is that someone has been treated differently because of their race or national origin, the fact that they have children, the fact of their gender or their gender identity or their source of income, their disability. There are actually 14 protected classes in Connecticut.
And who most likely will face housing discrimination in Connecticut?
The Connecticut Fair Housing Center has been in business for more than 25 years now, and the highest number of complaints that we are receiving these days is from people with disabilities. So people who either want to move from a nursing home back into the community or who are already living in the community but are having difficulty keeping their housing or making their housing safe for them. However, our own investigations that we have done show that there's also high degrees of discrimination against people of color, people who are Latino, people who are African American.
And is there also a connection with poverty when it comes to housing discrimination?
So one of the things that is a protected class in Connecticut is source of income. So if someone, for instance, has a housing voucher, usually called Section 8, or something called a RAP voucher, we find high degrees of discrimination in that. Unfortunately, those also tend to overlap with race and national origin discrimination. So a landlord is more likely to accept a tenant who is white with a housing voucher than a tenant who's black with a housing voucher.
And what about undocumented immigrants? What challenges do they face when finding a place to live?
So it depends on a lot of different factors. So for instance, many people who are Puerto Rican are treated as if they're not citizens because a lot of people don't understand that people who are Puerto Rican are in fact U.S. citizens. But what we're seeing is people are being treated differently depending upon the country that the landlord or the housing provider believes that they're from. So if someone were, for instance, to apply for an apartment, they have a charming Irish accent, they're not asked if they're citizens. But someone who has a Latino accent or someone who's African and has an African accent is usually asked if they are citizens or if they have papers that show that they're here legally.
Now, there are policies in place to discourage or to make housing discrimination illegal, of course. I believe you said 14 protected classes. Now, the fact that your organization needs to exist suggests that those policies aimed at stopping this housing discrimination don't work so well.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And in fact, since the beginning of the COVID-19 crisis, the number of calls we're getting has tripled over the same period last year. So there's a lot of housing discrimination out there. Some of it is because landlords or housing providers don't know the law, but a lot of it is a simple rejection of someone who looks different or acts different or is different than the housing provider.
Could you make that connection for me? What's the connection between housing discrimination and COVID-19?
So I think a lot of it has to do with people being very afraid of becoming homeless or losing their homes. And when they try to get specific information from the landlord, such as, I can't pay the rent this month, and are you going to evict me if I don't pay the rent, not understanding that there might be a moratorium, the tenants are either told, no, I won't work with you, or I've always wanted you out, so I'm going to go ahead and start an eviction action, even though the landlord can't. And then we get a call. Sometimes it is based on race or national origin or family status. So since kids have been home full time because schools have been shut down, we've been getting a lot more calls from tenants who have been threatened by their landlords because their kids are making too much noise during the day. And I think for a lot of people of color, they are the highest number of people who have had COVID-19, as well as the highest number of people who have become unemployed as a result of COVID-19. And so there's a lot of fear among the communities of color that they are not next going to be victimized by the eviction crisis.
The Federal CARES Act that offered extra unemployment benefits and a moratorium on evictions due to COVID-19 is ending, and Congress is still bickering over just what to do about that, how to extend benefits and protections. Are you hearing from a lot of people who expect to be evicted soon?
Yes. We hear from probably 5 to 10 people every day who are calling us to ask, what is going to happen. The Connecticut eviction moratorium expires on August 22nd. So what we tell them is nothing is going to happen until after August 22nd. But after that, we're not sure what will happen with people's housing.
Do you have the resources to help all of these people who call? You offer free investigative and legal services to people who believe they're looking at discrimination and, in this case, possibly eviction.
We probably have the resources to help people with their fair housing or discrimination cases. We do not have the resources to help people with eviction. And that's not just true of my office. All of the legal services offices that provide free legal assistance to people who are being evicted do not have the personnel to assist the people who are going to need it. And my board of directors has allowed the center to hire two additional staff to try to assist more people with eviction cases, but it's like a drop in the bucket in an ocean. You know, it's just a little bit more help. It's not really going to assist the number of people who actually need it. And when you look at the eviction court or the summary process court filings, about 90% of the landlords are represented by attorneys, and about 90% of the tenants are not.
We've been talking about renters for the most part here. Newsday on Long Island recently published an investigative report on how real estate agents steered home buyers to certain neighborhoods based on their race. Have you heard of anything similar happening in Connecticut? And is that something that the Connecticut Fair Housing Center deals with?
So, unfortunately, one of the things that I noted, and I was quoted extensively in the Newsday article because they gave me the results and were asking my opinion about them. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that was clear in the Newsday article is that there were very few home buyers who actually understood that they had been discriminated against, because steering, which is what was going on in that article, is so subtle. And we have done similar studies to the one that was quoted in the Newsday article, where we send someone who's African-American or Latino into a real estate agency, and they ask, you know, here's what I'm pre-qualified for, $300,000 mortgage. I have $30,000 as a down payment. I have good credit. Can you show me houses? And when we did that down in Fairfield County, sending people into real estate agencies in the city of Fairfield, the majority of the testers of color were told, no, I'm sorry, there's nothing available for you. But you could look in the suburbs or in Bridgeport itself. And when we sent in white testers who were not pre-qualified for a $300,000 mortgage and who didn't have as good credit, the majority of them were shown houses in the city of Fairfield. And in fact, in one instance, the real estate agent said, well, you know, you're pre-qualified for a mortgage of this amount. Let's go up to 325. Let's go up to 340, because we think you'll be able to either get a mortgage for this amount or possibly talk the seller into coming down on the price.
Is there something more that needs to be done from a policy perspective, from a legislative perspective, to put more pressure on real estate companies, I guess, and others to not do this?
I get that asked that often by real estate agents and real estate agencies. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I say is that the real estate business is about money. You know, it's not about doing good. It's not about helping people. It's about money. And a lot of real estate agents believe that they can only make money if they do the kind of discrimination or they do the kind of steering that we talk about. And certainly a lot of landlords believe that. And so I think what the answer is to make it not worth their monetary while to discriminate. And the only way to do that is by having more enforcement. And so in response to the Newsday article, State of New York has appropriated several million dollars to hand out to agencies like mine to ensure that there is more enforcement, that there is more oversight, that the people who are in the business of providing housing are actually following the rules.
Ms. Kemple, thanks so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Erin Kemple is the executive director of the Connecticut Fair Housing Center. That's it for the program today. Produced by Fatou Sangari and senior producer Ann Lopez. I'm Tom Kuser. Thank you for listening to The Full Story.